history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some incredible stories around you just waiting to be told. And we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, boy, do we learn a lot. We are educated, entertained. So often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation, like the story of Glenn Ferguson, a 96-year-old retired Marine Corps aviator who you got to hear a little bit from last time at the Flying Leatherneck Aviation Museum in San Diego. If you missed it, pull up episode number 521 at hometownheroesradio.com. Glenn's father had served in the Marines in World War I. In 1939, Glenn Jr. decided to follow in those Semper Fi footsteps, and we're going to pick things up in July 1942 when he received a unique assignment responsible for protecting a very important person.
They were setting up the retreat for Roosevelt called Shangri-La. It was a retreat up the Catoctin Mountains. It had been created by the CCC. There were three areas there. One area was taken over by the Secret Service to develop the house for the president. Then they put a big fence around that. It enclosed many acres. And then outside of that fence, about 10 foot outside of that fence, they put another fence, and it was the Marines' responsibility to patrol that inner perimeter, and you got shot if you got into that area. And one of the problems that we had was that a lot of the people that we were given for guards were out of the cities, didn't know how to live in the woods, and as a result, they killed off the black snakes before I found out about it. And it wasn't but a very short while later that we were overrun with copperheads, which are dangerous because they don't give you any warning and they're deadly. So anyhow, I got that stopped, but not soon enough. And then Roosevelt came up. He was upset because of all the guards that we had up there to protect him. We told him about the training we were giving. I was giving camouflage training and things like that. Anyhow, he asked a lot of questions, and he was satisfied and finally went back. At the same time that we had set that up, the department that was bringing people from Europe to train them over here and send them back to commit sabotage behind the lines.
OSS?
Yeah. It was OSS back in those days.
Yeah.
The OSS was training the people. Another sergeant and myself had set up the guards, and we had our own cabin that was built up on stilts. And these people would divide up into friend and enemy. For their graduation, they would have the enemy. The way I could tell that they were attacking was the sentry would hear something and challenge it. It'd be one of the officers. He would challenge in one language, answer in another language, and then talk in a third language. Anyhow, the whole idea was for the enemy to sneak in and attach a dynamite cap to the pilings that our cabin was built on. That's the only communication we had with them. They'd never tell us. But it was our friends, and so I never complained about it. It didn't happen that often. But that's the way I knew that we were being attacked that night.
And this is what we know now as Camp David?
Yeah. Eisenhower renamed it Camp David after his grandson. While all this was going on, they were building the east wing of the White House. And so then they pulled me down to become the receptionist for the east wing of the White House. I was given a desk and a phone, which was unusual for the east wing. And a lot of the important people like Madam Chiang Kai-shek, her brothers, the Sung brothers, and Madam Chiang Kai-shek would use the east wing. The top level of the government people would hold their meetings there once a month. At that time, the labor secretary was Ma Perkins, and she used to drive in a big black chauffeured limousine and park outside till all the rest of the people came in and assembled, and then she would march in and make a grand entrance. Dr. Lubin, Harry Hopkins, let's see, Admiral Lee. There were four officers down there. Hopkins, we had rationing back in those days. He ran not only here in the States, but overseas, too. We had a lot of control on the foreign countries because we were supplying them with so much stuff. So he had all of that control. Gone across the street from the White House, across from the Treasury, and got a bag of kettle corn, which was something new back in those days, and was standing there in the crossway to the big area that goes to the other side, holding that bag of kettle corn, and Harry Hopkins walked by and grabbed the corn out of my and went to the meeting eating it. He had a bad stomach. He wasn't supposed to eat that sort of stuff.
And I'm just listening to you, and I'm thinking about this 21-year-old kid, 22-year-old kid.
Yeah, that wanted to be overseas.
But you're around some of the most powerful people in the world, and you talked about Roosevelt giving you guys a hard time at Shangri-La, like, hey, that's just that guy over there. This is the President of the United States who you just heard on December 8th talking about the day that will live in infamy, and the whole country's listening to this guy.
Well, I can tell you a story about Roosevelt, too. The cross corridor. I was finally put out on quarters and rations and paid to rent a room, and it was only a couple of blocks from the White House. And so I would walk to work in the morning, and there was a delicatessen that I usually stopped at on the way to work. Got a carton of milk and a box of cookies. That was my breakfast. And so one morning I was a little late and I skipped it. And so I decided later on that morning that I'd go over to the West Wing to the mail room. They had a stand there with the bags of popcorn and candy and that sort of thing. So anyhow, I went over there and the Secret Service all knew me. So when I came back, they all said hi, good morning, that sort of thing, but didn't tell me the president was coming down. There was a big etching of Abraham Lincoln hanging on the side wall. I had never really looked at it carefully, so I decided to walk over close to it and look at it as I walked by. Well, it was right on the corner of a little anteroom where was the opening to the elevator from the second floor that they brought the president down in. He had polio, so he couldn't walk and was in a wheelchair and was pushed around. And so at the moment that I walked by that etching, the fellow pushed him out in a wheelchair. And I actually had one foot forward. How I ever stopped walking, I don't know. But I almost laid across his lap. That would have given me a good trip to Siberia. Anyhow, I said, good morning, President. And he didn't seem to know that anything had been close. And another little episode was, like I said, I was tired of sitting behind a desk. You know, I wanted to be overseas. And so I built a model airplane. Why I didn't get fired, I don't know. But I built a model airplane and took it out to fly it and flew up on the roof.
The roof of the White House.
Yeah, so I climbed out Eleanor Roosevelt's, I went up the second floor and climbed out the window of her office up there to the roof and got my airplane. Mr. Krim, who was the head usher that I worked for, he never said anything about it. I don't know whether he ever knew or not.
These days you might get shot trying to pull that off.
Well, nobody ever said anything to me, but I got my airplane back.
Well, and you mentioned something, the story about almost landing in the president's lap. You saw it up close and personal. You knew what most of America didn't know, that he was confined to a wheelchair.
Oh, yeah, because the press was pretty good about showing him standing up. If you notice, when he stood up, he was always supported by somebody because he had braces that he had to lock when he stood up and straightened out his legs, they would lock the braces, and then he would hang on to his sons or somebody, a cabinet member, in order to walk up to the podium and that sort of thing. If you notice, he never walked very far, just a few steps.
And as far as his personality or his significance as the president you had known for most of your life at that point, is there some light you can shed on him as a person that maybe people who didn't get as close to the action White House-wise as you did might not expect?
Well, I suppose in answer to your question is they built a big swimming pool there in the bottom floor of the White House, and they kept it very hot. It was always steamy because of his polio. So they did a lot of work with him there at the White House, but I didn't have any social action with him. He was a little out of my grade.
What was your perspective on him? What did you think of him? Did you get a sense of maybe the weight that he carried on his shoulders?
Well, I thought he was pretty good in most respects, but he was a little bit liberal and too trusting. At that time, people didn't realize it, but the communists were so open that I can remember walking by a place that was downstairs of a big building, and it actually had a communist title or something on the window advertising their club space. The communists were pretty open back in those days. I didn't think that was right, because we knew, or at least as far as I was concerned, I knew what the communists were about, but they were given pretty free rein. And at the end of the war, I was told about a plane that flew to Europe and was forced down by Russian pilots. It was in Yugoslavia that they were forced down. When they found out it was a British plane, they apologized and said, "Oh, we thought you were Americans." They were loading up the transport planes with all kinds of material from different plants, because at that time, remember, most of the plants had stopped, like auto manufacturers had stopped building cars and were building tanks and things like that. Anyhow, they got into the inner works of the different companies and stole a lot of their secret material, secret to the company, a lot of the secret material from the government, our secret material. They were loading planes up, transport planes full of that stuff, and flying it to Russia. That's how they got the atomic bomb, as far as I'm concerned, is they stole it from us.
And I don't want to linger too long on this, because I know we've got a lot more to go in your aviation career, but I'm just thinking about you again as this young kid at what we know now as Camp David, this presidential retreat, which is just in its infancy. But when you're out there, your job is to protect the president of the United States. Did that weigh on you? Was that a pressure job, high anxiety, or no big deal?
Once again, I'm a Marine. I do what I'm told. I don't think anything about it. But I'll tell you a little incident, though, that kind of bothered us. We went on Liberty down to Hagerstown, Maryland, down the mountain. The lieutenant would appoint one of the men as an MP liaison. He had to be an MP rather than on Liberty. One of the fellows that we got in our unit was an older man, but he was only a corporal. In other words, he hadn't been in too long. We had to be aboard the truck to leave at 10 o'clock. And he ordered everybody out of this restaurant we were all in, waiting for the truck. He ordered everybody out to get ready for the truck. The answer was, "Hey, the truck's not even here yet. We're not going out." And so he pulled out his .45, and it was loaded. If he'd been able to fire it, it would have done a number on somebody. Anyhow, there was a guy standing next to him that grabbed it in a way. When he pulled the trigger, the firing pin struck the web of his, he deliberately grabbed it in that fashion so that it couldn't strike the firing pin. That would have made quite a mess if the press had gotten a hold of that little detail.
Yeah.
You can imagine shooting up a bunch of guards down there in Hagerstown.
Oops.
How did that happen?
And you said that while you're there and you're at the White House, you really wanted to be off fighting this war.
Yeah, I belonged overseas as far as I was concerned.
So what'd you do about that?
Well, I'd put in for flight training. I kept expecting to go flight training. And finally, one day, Mr. Krim came down and said, "Hey, Fergie, what's going to happen to you? You going to flight training?" I said, "I don't know. Nobody's talking to me." He said, "Do you mind if I check?" And I said, "No, go ahead." And he sat down on my phone and called the Commandant of the Marine Corps and said, "What's going to happen?" Well, of course, Commandant didn't know me from Adam. So I had orders to report to the colonel in charge of flight selection. I had to report to him the following day, the morning. And so I went up to see him, and he really grumbled. He didn't like that order at all. But he'd been in Washington enough to know where his bread was buttered. He didn't know what kind of attachments that I had, who I knew or how close I was to him. So he was afraid to touch me. And he didn't have anything to hang his hat on. Everywhere I'd been, they gave me outstanding marks. And so he grumbled a bit. And I could see he was what we call a ring knocker. He was wearing an academy ring. What the trouble was, I had resigned from the Naval Academy Prep School, and he didn't like that. He thought that I was somebody inferior because I wouldn't go to the academy. So anyhow, he put me back on the flight list, and eventually I was called to flight training.
And the war's still going on. How exciting was that for you to actually get in the air and do some flying?
Well, it's what I'd wanted for ever since I was a young kid, to fly airplanes. So I was finally off and running.
And at that point, he couldn't even imagine where his aviation dreams might take him. We're going to get a taste of that when we come back, from dive bombers to the 1st Marine Corps helicopters. For photographs relating to Mr. Ferguson, his story, and his favorite museum, the Flying Leatherneck Aviation Museum in San Diego, go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. Nearly 1,000 veterans have gotten to see their memorials for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 96-year-old Glenn Ferguson Jr., coming your way from the Flying Leatherneck Aviation Museum in San Diego, where Glenn is involved in quite a few forward-looking initiatives, including a very unique award we're going to hear about shortly. But for now, we're looking back into the past, and specifically to World War II. After more than 3 years in the Marine Corps, he finally got to do what he'd always wanted to do.
I wound up flying about 20 different aircraft. We started out in the old biplanes, the old N2S, which is fabric covered.
Yeah.
Doped. The way we started it was to put a crank in and crank up the flywheel to get it going enough that the pilot could pull a pin on it and turn the engine. That's how we got them started. First, I went to Chapel Hill, North Carolina. It was just ground school. And then on our way up to Bunker Hill, we took a train. The day before that we arrived, they'd had a bad windstorm and the planes couldn't get back to the field. So all along, all those farmers' fields on the way on the alongside of the track, because people used to use what we called the iron beam, the railroad tracks, where our beam is place of the radio beam. Anyhow, they were obviously following the railroad tracks and would run out of gas, or they couldn't get to the field because of the weather. Because the weather in Indiana can really roll in and roll bad. So they were forced down. All along the line, there were the yellow perils nosed up in the fields. That's a good invitation to to people who are going to fly them.
People who don't know what you're talking about when you say yellow perils, that's what they called those fabric-covered biplanes.
Yeah, the N2S. Yeah. Yeah.
So you were probably excited to graduate from that flimsy little thing.
Well, we graduated from there and went to outlying fields of Pensacola and went through the rest of our flight training in an SNJ. The wheels fold up. It was actually used as a fighter plane in South America for a while. It was a big improvement over what we had been flying.
Was there a plane that you had seen, that you'd heard about, that you were really hoping to get a chance to fly?
Well, of course, everybody that went through flight training wanted to become a fighter pilot.
Sure.
But, you know, we had need for pilots and everything else. So many of us got assigned other things. When I graduated from Pensacola, I was assigned dive bombers. So I went to the field in Jacksonville to learn to dive bomb. There were dive bombers and torpedo bombers and transports, but the fighters and those that were going to fly float planes, anything of that nature, would stay there at Pensacola.
Did you have a favorite of those planes that you got to fly?
Well, people ask me that all the time, and I don't really have a favorite per se, but I did like the, later on I got into helicopters, and I liked the HO-5S. I could do anything in that thing, and oftentimes had to.
Well, I want to hear about that, but let's wrap up World War II first. So you're in a couple of years before America gets drawn into the war, and as it's nearing the end of the war, you're training to go over and fight the Japanese?
What happened is that we formed up a bunch of pilots to create a new dive bombing squadron. We went out through Miramar, which was at that point a shipping point, a collection point for people in Western going out to the Pacific and so forth. Anyhow, they got us all together and put us aboard a destroyer transport, a destroyer that had been converted to ship troops in a hurry overseas. And we were all aboard that and went out to Eva. We formed the new squadron 343 at Eva, the dive bombing squadron. We were supposed to be in the first wave to bomb Japan, and of course, when they dropped the bombs, then they didn't need us to bomb Japan anymore. So they changed our orders to Tsingtao, China. And so that's how I wound up in North China.
And which dive bombers were you flying?
Well, at that time, it was the SB-2C. We had flown the SB-2C here in the States, but it was the Army model, the SB-2C-1A. And it was designed for the Army rockets. They didn't like it, so they gave it to the Marine Corps, naturally. And we flew it and overstressed it. And the pilot, two planes ahead of me in a rocket run, just shed his wings. Then a few days later, another pilot was in the landing pattern, ready to make a landing, and popped his flaps. It's all electrical. They had a big box behind the pilot seat with electrical contacts, and they would get corrosion, is obviously what happened. But anyhow, he popped his flaps, and dive flaps on one side went up, and the landing flaps on the other side went down, put them in a snap roll. At 1,500 feet in a landing pattern, that's not the place to do a snap roll. Anyhow, he got it down, and we looked at his wings, and they had been pulled away from the fuselage. Why he didn't shed them, I don't know, but they'd been pulled away from the fuselage, and the general said, well, that's enough. But we still continued. I looked in my logbook, and it still shows the 1A. Anyhow, a few days later, I was up and popped my flaps, and it tried to snap me. But I was ready for it, over-controlled it, and it was able to keep my wings level, but I had to increase my speed in order to get more aileron control. So I had to land at 140 knots, which is pretty fast.
Ooh. Hope you had a long runway.
At El Toro. Thank goodness it was a long runway, because I used it all.
I bet you did. And it sounds like you're saying the only reason you were ready for it is because you saw what had happened to the other pilot.
Well, we knew what could happen with those things.
And have you ever thought what would have happened to you if you had been part of that invasion force, if you're dive bombing these heavily defended Japanese targets?
You don't think of those things. If you're going to fly, you better be a fatalist. I had a friend who did think of things like that, and he had to quit. He quit and became a school teacher in Chicago. If you're a pilot, you're a fatalist. You know, you're going to get it, you're going to get it. That's just part of the game.
And you said something there. So Japan surrenders, and you get sent to China. And a lot of people aren't aware of what was still happening there.
Oh, it was really happening. Mao Tse-tung, well, to start with, Truman, he wasn't in the loop. FDR deliberately kept him out of the loop. He didn't know what was going on over in Asia. And so he sent Marshall over to investigate and see what was going on, who we should support, either Chiang Kai-shek or Mao. He came back. Mao had led him around by the nose and showed him everything that Mao wanted him to see. And so he came back and said, those people are nothing but poor agrarian farmers, and they were shooting at us up north. People don't realize that the Manchurian army didn't surrender at the Tokyo Bay. They surrendered in October to a Marine general at the racetrack, and I have a picture of it.
So over there as a dive bomber pilot, what were you guys doing until that Manchurian army surrendered in October of 45?
Well, right at the beginning, Mao started showing his teeth and was doing a lot of things, taking over provinces and so forth. And so they decided to have a show of force over Peiping. Had our planes also joined, it was a big show of force because there were a lot of squadrons that were assigned over there, but then the dive bombing squadrons that were there in Tsingtao. So they sent our bombing squadrons over there to join the force. Luckily, I wasn't assigned that day, but the flight leader was taking the flight back home. And because of the lack of instrument training, he rightfully decided to fly under the clouds. But he got into a valley, and the clouds trapped him against the mountains, so he had to climb through them. And in climbing through them, he wiped off the bottom half of the squadron on the mountaintop. Then the TBM squadron was flying the railroad patrol. They had lost three men, so we had a mass burial a little later on. We had 10 men in the burial. You had to have an officer sign off. There was a body in the casket, so I was the officer that was assigned to that, and I saw the remains of our pilots. They were like a sandbag stuffed full of sand, a big sandbag. No arms, no legs, no heads. That was what they looked like, you know, sand in a sandbag. Anyhow, then we had to go down to Okinawa to pick up some new planes to replace those that we lost. But on our patrols, we got shot at once in a while. But the northern patrols got shot at every day. The Mao Tse-sung patrols were really active. And one of the men who was in my squadron that had bailed out of the plane before they hit the mountains, he never flew again. It scared him so bad. But he said he went belly to belly with the plane. Now, how you do that, I don't know. But anyhow, that scared him so badly, he never flew again.
Well, and I heard you when you said that, you know, to be a pilot, you had to be a fatalist. Either you were going to get it or you didn't. But I'm sure the reality was when that all came to an end, and those guys you just described who died after the Japanese surrender, they're counted among the 406,000 Americans who were killed during those 4 years of World War II. I'm sure there were some guys that you knew that
lost
their lives
in the war. Oh, yeah, I
knew them
all. Yeah.
Knowing all those men who paid that price, who didn't get to come home from the war, who didn't get to go on and have families the way you did, and here you are almost 97 years old, still going strong. When you think about those guys, what should we remember?
Well, they were Marines. They did their job. They paid for it. That's what you have to expect if you join the Marine Corps, that you may or may not come home. It depends upon the circumstances and your luck. Those men weren't the first ones that I had lost, friends that I had lost. When I was in the bombing school, about the second flight. Back in the old days, the SBD, the first model, had a long telescope as a sight. And the problem with that was that if you looked through that scope, you had a tendency to look at it too long to pick up your target. People don't realize that you would go into the target, say at 10 or 12,000 feet, you'd peel off and dive into the target, hopefully downwind, and the wind would tend to push you off the target. But one way or another, you were subject to all the crosswinds, all the varieties of directions that the wind could sometimes pull on you. So you were constantly corkscrewing around, fighting to stay on target. If you were looking through that scope, you got what we call target fixation. And that's what happened to Jimmy. Apparently he got target fixation. He missed the center point, the crosshairs, by 8 feet. He just dove right straight in. That was the first friend that I lost that way. And I lost others due to different problems, night flying and that sort of thing.
Was that hard to handle as a young man?
No. Once again, that was just part of the game.
And you never thought that could be me?
Well, the one time that I reacted in that way was when I crashed a fighter plane at El Toro. I was upside down, gas dripping into my face, and I couldn't get out. I had to have the crash crew man help me. I couldn't get my right parachute strap unbuckled.
Was this when you were a test pilot after World War II?
No, that was when I was in a fighter plane, F4U fighter plane.
Oh, you're flying a Corsair?
Yeah.
Still training during the war?
We went off on what we called a group grope. The whole group took off. Mm-hmm. That takes a lot of planes, a lot of time to get airborne and then get them back. So I was in the middle of the flight, and I was left-hand. We were landing at El Toro, four planes abreast, which is, you don't usually do that.
Right.
You know, because if one plane crashes, you might get the rest of them. So anyhow, we were landing four abreast in order to get everybody back in time, because I was on the left-hand side of the left flight. When I landed, the wind tilted my wing, because I was getting a burble from the wind coming from my right, which tilted, and I was getting everybody else's prop wash. That kind of tilted me up a little bit, and a contractor left a big pile of dirt on the left-hand side of the left runway, and my wing ticked it. Well, that's all it took to spin me off the runway, and I went tooling across the boondocks, and there was a big ditch. It was big enough that they said I actually got airborne. Anyhow, the nose dug in, and I flipped over. Like I said, I had to have the crash crew help me get out.
So you ended up upside down in a ditch with gas dripping out?
Yeah. Normally, they catch fire.
Yeah.
But it didn't in this case. I had a buddy do a similar incident later on. He caught fire. But anyhow, my wife wasn't there at that time. I had just come back from a school and had her in Washington, D.C. with her folks and my two boys, and she had flown out back out. We were going to a squadron party, and so I stopped her outside the house and told her that I had crashed a plane. But, you know, it's 2 weeks ago. I had flown a lot since then, so there was nothing for her to worry about. That was the only time that I have reacted to. You know, I've had all sorts of things. I've blown up engines and had all sorts of forced landings and that sort of thing. But if you fly, you can't worry about flying, not be a good pilot.
But that one got to you because you thought of your wife and your two boys?
Well, it didn't get to me. It was a matter that I thought I'd better say something about it for fear that they would say something at the party.
You wanted her to hear it from you.
Yeah.
And after World War II, before you became a pioneering helicopter pilot, you were a test pilot for some other Marine Corps planes, is that right?
Well, they normally would assign a pilot as a test pilot in a different squadrons, and all that really meant was that you were the guy that was suckered in, and you had to take a plane whenever they did heavy maintenance. Then you were the one that had to go up and fly an hour over the field in case you lost an engine. And so I was a test pilot in that sense. But I was later assigned as a field service test pilot at Patuxent on the HOK before we got the HOK. So I was a test pilot in that sense, but not a test pilot that was permanently assigned like you find pilots in the Air Force at Edwards or the Navy. Comparable spot is Patuxent, Maryland, where they send the new planes for testing.
Well, and here at the Flying Leatherneck Aviation Museum, you can see a lot of different iterations of helicopters. But you were flying some of the earliest models. How far a cry is that from what we know today?
We have what we call the barn over here, where we have other aircraft other than what you see displayed. And there's a Bell and an HOK over there. That goes back to the Marine Corps really got started in helicopters in 1947 when General Hubbard was sent out to, remember the big atomic bomb test that they had out in the Pacific?
Bikini.
Where they had all the ships anchored,
yeah.
And then they blew up the bombs to see what damage it did to the different. Well, he went out and he saw that, and he knew instantly that we could no longer land Marines the way that we used to. We couldn't form them up and congregate them into a big force to make a landing such as we'd done before with the ships close by and that sort of thing. They had to be dispersed. And so in order to be dispersed and get the Marines back together again, we had to have a different method of doing that. And so at that time, they were aware of the helicopters. And that's when they formed HMX as an experimental squadron. And they sent five HO5Ss to HMX to take part in an exercise where they would take the Marines from ship to shore to prove out what they eventually developed into what we call the vertical envelopment. Anyhow, that proved valid enough that in 1947 was really the start of our vertical development concept. The problem was we didn't have the planes nor the pilots in those days. So we had to develop all of that, which took time. And by that time, the Korean War came along. There were two concepts that were developed at the same time. One was the prompt evacuation of the casualties, and the second was the vertical envelopment, which is what everybody was interested in. So when the Korean War came along, they sent 161 out there to create the vertical envelopment. We called them our rich cousins because they got all the supplies and we got nothing. In VMO, which is where I was with the squadrons that picked up the wounded in the Bell helicopter.
Is it true that some of the early helicopters that you flew were held together by bungee cords?
Well, the allusion to that has to do with the HO5S. Control forces in the HO5S are so great that when you first tried to fly the plane, you didn't have enough muscle. And so you had to learn how to get your body twisted around or you could push your arm into it to get control of the stick. And in order to help you, they put bungee cords down below on the bottom of the stick that were attached to a motor, and you had a thumb button in the top of the stick that would control the motor in one of four motors, whatever direction you wanted to pull it. The problem was that they would always, after a couple of days, stretch those bungee cords or they weren't doing any good. Like I had a fella in my class who was small. He carried a cushion with him in order to push himself further forward to get more control on the stick. That's where the bungee cord came from.
It's break time again, but when we come back with 96-year-old Glenn Ferguson, the dangerous but life-saving duty he had during the Korean War, yet another president with whom he served closely, and the unique award he helped launch at the Flying Leatherneck Aviation Museum in San Diego. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an hour flying by way too quickly with 96-year-old retired Marine Corps aviator Glenn Ferguson here at the Flying Leatherneck Aviation Museum in San Diego. We've heard about how he went from flying airplanes to those primitive helicopters in the late 40s and early 50s, and it sounds like you got used to flying helicopters pretty quickly.
And the reason for that is I come up from the troops. Unlike other pilots who had come in and got their wings, I had come up through the ground units and therefore had an affinity for the ground units. That's unusual for aviation people. We have to teach them that. We have a school that does that very thing. But anyhow, because I had come from the ground, I enjoyed working with the ground and did a lot of things, set up some programs to work with company commanders and so forth. But anyhow, because I worked with the ground. I enjoyed the helicopters because we worked with the ground in the helicopters. As a matter of fact, I had a detachment down at Vieques one time, and when I had a detachment, I ran my own mess hall, and as a result, I had an ice-making machine, and I used to fill up one of those old cans that they used to carry milk in. I used to fill those up with ice and go out and find the troops that were relaxing for the time being. They had stopped their exercise and were relaxing. Anyhow, one reason or another, they were sitting alongside the road, and I'd land and give them all this ice. So I did things like that with the ground troops. When I was at Camp Lejeune, we had a lot of trouble with the people approaching the wrong way, chopping down three trees in the woods, and tell us to land in the hole that we made. That's dangerous. So anyhow, how do we get our message across to these people? With the school, with learning and teaching. So I went over to the ground units and got a hold of the company commander and said, let's set up a program for them. He would bring out his people, and I would fly over there with my crew chief, who would assemble them in a line. I would fly, just pick them up and fly around and land, pick another one up, fly around and land. It did two things. One, it showed them a helicopter, which they had never seen before, got a chance to fly in a helicopter and write home about it. So it got us a lot of publicity that way. Plus, the big thing was teaching them how to operate with a helicopter, that you can't come from the rear. We actually killed a colonel one day because he ran into the tail rotor. He didn't learn the lesson. Yeah. Anyhow, that's what I enjoyed doing, was working with the troops.
Well, and you worked closely with troops and evacuated a lot of them in Korea. But what was that like to head overseas to a war zone knowing you're leaving behind your wife and those two sons?
That's the Marine Corps.
That's just the way it is.
Yeah.
Once a Marine, always a Marine.
Oh, well.
So you flew 134 medical evacuation missions over there in Korea? And some of those were at night.
Well, a lot of them were at night, yeah.
Did that make things trickier?
Oh, yeah. The problem with flying at night, especially on a dark night, was that in order to see at night, you have rods and cones in your eyes. With the cones, you see colors, but with the rods, you see only dark. You don't see any colors. And you can't focus on a cone like you do on the colors. The focus point is different for the rods. And as a result, you have to look slightly to the side in order to see when there's not enough light to give you color. So right from the beginning, you got to have a problem of what are you going to focus with? Now, when we went into a landing zone, they were supposed to have four flare pots, one at each corner of the square that you're supposedly landing on. Because the flare pots were burning, you could tell the direction of the wind and the velocity of the wind from the way the flame was operating. Mm-hmm. The problem was we had used up all of our supplies in the landings going over to Korea. You know, we had to rush over there, the Marine Corps. Then they were pulled out and sent up to make the landing at Incheon. Well, as an example, the Army had resupplied their units three times. We were still working with what we had used at Incheon. So as a result, the best thing we could expect when we went in for a landing was the FAC, or whoever was bringing us in, would have a pen light. Now, you can't really establish a horizon with a pen light. The way we used to fly up there was to fly by the starlight, either the starlight up above the horizon or in the river. And I can tell you a story about one time flying in the river. But anyhow, the problem with that was that there was always a haze on the horizon, so you only flew to the starlight that was above the horizon. If you flew too long towards the lines, there's no light on the lines. If you flew too long in that direction, you were constantly climbing. That wasn't good. So we learned to fly the rivers, you know, as far as you could, and you'd see the starlight in the river, and you're looking down. Well, once in a while, and this happened to me one time, there was a fog that came off the river, and you'd fly into the fog. Now, the instruments in a helicopter are kaput. They don't work. because you never know what your balance is. So we didn't have instruments that we could fly on. The best thing you could do if you got into bad weather was to reverse. But anyhow, because I was looking down instead of ahead, I got into this cloud and was just about to spin in. That's when you try to fly straight and level. What's level? You don't know.
You've got no bearings.
Because you could have a heavy weight on one side or the other side, and there's nothing to tell you what level is. So anyhow, I promptly made a turn, but in a turn, that's dangerous because you don't know what you're doing in a turn. What saved me was at that moment, there was a tank on the lines that turned on its lights, and that gave me visual reference then. They don't turn them on too long because then they'll take incoming fire. But if the people in the forward position hear some noise, they'll call back to the tank to ask him to flash his light. That's what he did. He flashed his light. But that was enough for me because I'd already made part of my turn to get out of that mess I was in. But anyhow, I got in and they started shelling us. The thing was, it was cut into the side of a hill, so if they were a little short or a little over, it was landing either up above or down below. And both the FAC and myself dived over a bunker, and I lost my pen light, so I had to go back the next day to pick up my pen light.
Obviously, this is a dangerous job, and you're risking your life to save the lives of these wounded men and get them out of there.
That's what a Marine does.
And you've been very consistent with that. But you're not just risking yourself because it's dark, you can't see where you're going, you're in these helicopters that can be tough to control, tough to know where you are. But there were people shooting at you also.
They had a rule out. It was never given directly to me, so I felt I could violate it and get away with it, which I did. But we could only go up to the front lines, pick up wounded from the front line and fly them back to the med station, which sometimes was just a matter of minutes because we were up so far then. Unlike what you see in the movie MASH, our MASH units were up right behind the lines in regimental reserve area. If you looked at my logbook, you'd see some flights are only minutes long. As a matter of fact, I talked to a doctor, and he said that we were getting the men back so fast that they had to change their medical procedures. In the past, they would save the man that they thought could last long enough to be saved because he would be dragged out of the fighting area back to where they could put him on an ambulance, and maybe they'd have to go way down to find a bridge to go across a river to get back up to the med station. And that took a lot of beating and time to do that, whereas we just flew straight across. We would get them there in minutes. If it would be so soon that they'd have to let the man lay there and slightly recover from the shock before they could operate on him. And he said because of that, they were changing their medical procedures. So we were doing a lot of good in that sense.
Well, yeah, here in a war that's claiming lives left and right, you're saving lives. And what I hear you saying is that threshold of who can be saved, who is a savable casualty, changed because of the presence of you and those other helicopter pilots.
That's correct. They now could pick a man who was the most wounded and put him on the table and save his life as well as the man that could last a lot. Sometimes we would get a man that was wounded in such a way that they would ask us to take him all the way back to the hospital ship. Now here's a man that's been out in the field, got shot, and within an hour be back aboard a hospital, you know, nice clean sheets and everything, nurses, within an hour, if you were lucky and didn't have bad weather or something. But we'd fly down to Seoul and turn right there and go over to Incheon, and then off of Incheon, the ships, we would sometimes take them directly out there.
And just to underscore it, what would have happened to those guys before the helicopters became part of this?
Well, it had to do with the nerve damage. If it was a particular type of nerve damage, well, the corpsman would make the decision. We didn't know anything about them. All they were doing is loading our litters and putting the hood on them, and we were flying them out. We didn't know what was wrong with them other than being wounded.
Am I oversimplifying it to say that before the helicopters became involved, those guys would have died before they ever got the treatment?
Probably would have died, yeah.
Yeah.
Most of the people that we carried would have died had we not been there. But because we were able to get them back so fast, they were able to get them on the table in time.
Does that give you some satisfaction?
Well, yeah.
There's some guys out there. There's some children and grandchildren who would have never been born.
That's right. There's a lot of them walking around because we were there. And that's what I liked about it. I had been bombing and rocketing, shooting rockets, that sort of thing. But what I really liked was going out and picking up the wounded. That's a satisfaction. You picked up people and saved their lives.
And you survived all of it. And I know you're not looking for attention for this, but you've casually mentioned a few times that you have had some close calls, and you told us about the plane upside down in the ditch. But what would you say was your closest call in a helicopter?
I never measured it. but I had several. One of them, the Undersecretary of the Navy wanted to see Camp Lejeune, and in order to see that, that's a pretty big size post. So he decided that he would take helicopters. So we flew them around. Whenever I flew, I always figured out, now if I lost an engine, where am I going to go? Because you have all of the flying properties of a brick.
Yeah, you're going down fast.
Yeah. So anyhow, I had picked out this spot. It was where they showed the movies, and I had all these pipes sticking up. I didn't really like that, but that was the only opening in the woods. So that was my spot to land if I lost an engine. So I finally went beyond that point and picked out another one. But it was a little bit too far ahead, but it was a big open area, so I picked out that spot. Anyhow, my engine blew up right at the wrong spot. That was in an H-05S. I had enough experience in it that I was able to hump it over the edge of the trees and got it down. Cockpit full of smoke. I always think about the passenger. This guy's probably wondering, is this pilot know what he's doing?
And you say that so matter-of-factly. Yeah, my engine blew up. What does that sound and feel like when you're in the air and that happens?
I'll tell you, the cockpit filled with smoke immediately. The fact that I was up forward, the smoke was behind me, and I was able to stick my head out the door and that sort of thing. But the poor passenger, he's got to sit there and wonder, what's going to happen now?
Yeah, what did he look like when you brought that thing down and you got out of it?
I don't know. We got out and stood up. I didn't measure him.
I wonder how long he waited before he got on a helicopter.
But I don't think he had any time in planes. He certainly didn't have them in helicopters. It must have been a clutch factor.
I would imagine so.
But, I'd done so many auto rotations by that time that to me it was just another auto rotation. We took a cylinder out of the engine, and you cut them in half right where the wrist pin goes through, and it makes a wonderful ashtray. And so we presented him with a cylinder head as an ashtray.
I'm sure he treasured that. Well, I don't want to leave anything out that's important to you, and I understand here we talked about you hanging around FDR as a youngster, and a couple decades later, you're flying Eisenhower around the country?
Oh, yeah. I was assigned to HMX. Eisenhower was the president at that time. That was back in the early days. He was up north where all the elite go to have their vacations, and he had to get back to the White House in a hurry. And we happened to have a little Bell helicopter up across the bay for any emergency that the Secret Service would have. They called on that helicopter, and they flew him back with that Bell helicopter. That was the beginning of it, and they started flying helicopters then with Eisenhower. It turned out to be a really big plus, because now he could fly around with a lot of prestige and take presidents in other countries that he was visiting, which he did, take them up and show them areas in their own country that they had never seen before.
So when we see now, we see Marine One landing on the lawn of the White House, and the president gets out and waves. You were part of the start of that. One of the first Marine One pilots.
Yeah, but we were flying different kinds of airplanes, like the one that's out here, what we call an HUS. We dialed up four of those to make them presidential planes and did special work on them and that sort of thing and kept them separate. What would happen is they would fly the president from one city to another. We would pre-position the helicopters so that he could be picked up where he landed in that city and be flown around that area. Then he would go back to Air Force One and fly to another city and leapfrogging all the way around.
Was it any different flying with the president aboard?
Well, yeah, it's different in that you do the utmost to protect. The thing I didn't like it back in those days, and they've taken care of that now. Back in those days, we just flew one plane. And so I was always watching out to see if any plane was going to attack us.
Now they have a decoy helicopter, so you don't know which one the president's actually in.
They have three planes, and they run them around so that you don't know for sure which one's taking off. There's still a bad situation in that we take off in the South Lawn. I don't know what they may have done something about it now, but I was always concerned about somebody being in a truck just outside the South Lawn with some kind of a launcher, and he could step out and shoot the launcher and jump back in the truck and take off. Because at that time, you knew if you were taking off from the South Lawn, you're probably flying the president.
Well, and I'm just comparing your response to this to everything else you've talked about. I mean, you've been pretty consistent saying the danger here didn't bother you, that didn't bother you, this didn't bother you. It sounds like the weight of carrying the president of the United States made you on heightened alert to the potential dangers.
Well, that was our job. We're flying in a single plane up to Camp David or someplace. They knew who it was. And secondly, we had nothing around us to...
No escort?
No,
nothing.
Not in those days. Now it's a lot different. Now you've got a problem getting to them, which is good. That's the way it should be.
Well, you've given me a lot of your time already, but I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country and sharing some of your story. Is there something that, with your long history in the Marine Corps, you'd say that you're most proud of?
Most proud of? Being a Marine.
I knew you were going to say that. What is it about being a Marine? What's so special about that?
Because we are special.
I'm sure there are a lot of things in the museum that you enjoy, but I'm guessing there's one particular spot that you have a special fondness for, because there's an award over there amidst all these trophies that are given annually from all of Marine Corps Aviation. All four air wings in the Marines compete, and you see each winner next to every trophy out there. And then there's a plaque on the wall for an award that most people probably wouldn't expect. And it was your idea?
Well, the general and I, you know, I've been all over the world. I've been in a lot of parks, a lot of museums, been a lot of places. Never did I see a trophy or monument or statue to Marine wives. Now, how did we get overseas? Because a wife behind us took care of the family. Now, when you lose a wife and you start doing the ironing and the dishes and making the bed, you find out it's a lot of work. She had to get the kids to school in the morning, had to take care of when they fall down and scrape their knees and that sort of thing. That's a hell of a job.
Not to mention wondering if you're going to die in a helicopter crash or get shot down what's going to happen to you.
I think they adapt the same as he. That washes off. Anyhow, I thought, well, here we marry these girls. We take them out of school at a young age. We automatically inject them into the military life. No preparation for that. Yet they cope with it, and they do a wonderful job. It's because of them that we can go overseas. We get accolades and medals, see important people, where she's back home with all this mundane stuff. I thought we should recognize that, and so that's what brought it about.
So when your wife passed away, you worked with the general and the museum to start an award for the best Marine wife. So when I look at that plaque out there and it says the Irene Ferguson Memorial Marine Wife of the Year, every name that's on that plaque now, have you gotten to meet each one of those ladies?
Oh, yeah. The men submit the nominations. Pat sends me copies of the submissions, and I like to read them. Some of these women are phenomenal. You wonder how they find so much time to do it. Take care of 3, 4, 5 kids and go to school and get their degrees and just do everything. It's illuminated a lot of women that I don't think people knew about before. This way, they get to know it.
Well, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but the sense I get after taking just a brief tour of the museum, kind of on the opposite side, there's a hallway, and it says the Hall of Heroes. And here are all the Marine Corps aviators who've been awarded our highest decoration, the Medal of Honor. And then on the other side, here's that plaque with your wife's name on it and the Marine Wife of the Year. And it sounds like you see them as the heroes behind the heroes.
That's right. That's right. And they are.
If it was important enough for you to be part of this honor that is celebrating the wives among the Marine Corps today, you must have thought that your wife was a pretty amazing Marine wife.
She was. I still can't talk about her. I get all choked up. But we were married for 67 years. She did a wonderful job, never complained.
And I'm sorry I never had the privilege of meeting her, but I think
she was a beautiful woman. First reaction that people have when they see the pictures, she was beautiful.
Well, and it's a beautiful legacy. And I know we could sit here for hours. I'd love to hear about the other close calls from a quarter century in the Marine Corps. But I can tell you're looking forward toward ways that you can make a difference. And I think you're probably also aware that you've beaten some pretty significant odds with everything you've been through to be looking forward towards your 97th birthday in October.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Since I'm so old, I thought, well, after my wife and that sort of thing, I thought, well, I've got all this extra time. I should do something good with it. I've been granted it for some reason. Why not do some good with it?
Amen. Glenn Ferguson, retired Marine Corps major. He had more to say than we could fit into our radio time today. So if you pull up the podcast version of this episode at hometownheroesradio.com, you'll be able to hear even more of his memories. Thanks again to General Bob Butcher and his amazing team of volunteers at the Flying Leatherneck Aviation Museum at Marine Corps Air Station Miramar in San Diego. And thank you for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.